The field of gravity control and even warp drive is the more recent paper I've done for the State 2 conference. I think he was heading in the right direction. I unfortunately believe that some people at the CIA may have been feeding him a line of BS to try to you know, steer him away from what they were really doing. Not Gordon's fault, but he had too much trust in the people that he trusted, unfortunately.
Well, if I could jump in here for a minute about that. I'm not sure Gordon really trusted all these people that much. He was kind of like trust and verify. And don't you get that impression, Jim Mars, that he knew that they were playing him a little bit? But I think he did quite a lot of research and showed his intellect on this project. He believed in it completely and thoroughly.
Jerry, before we go to Jim's response, is Bill on the line? Bill Ryan, are you on the line?
Well, hi there. It's a pleasure to join you guys. And I was very sad to hear the news this morning, and thank you very much for inviting me to a short tribute here.
Hey, Bill.
Bill Ryan, it's great to hear your voice.
It's great for you to come on, Bill. You know, I was sharing with people what happened at the television show, how CIA tried to make them an offer they shouldn't refuse. In terms of, if you remember that little anecdote when we met with Gordon and I.
Well, I, this is Jim. I would like to get one thing real straight here, and I do tend to believe this. Gordon continually emphasized to me that he never, ever worked for the CIA. Okay, now, technically speaking, was he a hired employee? You know, did he have an employment file? Did he get a monthly paycheck? No, okay? So in that respect, technically, I do believe Gordon when he said he never technically worked for the CIA. But he had been connected with people. With the CIA all the way back to his manhood in New Orleans. And to address Derry's question, yes, I think he kind of held him at arm's length. I think he understood, like all of us know now, you can't trust them. They live in a world of lies and deceit. And so you never really know who's telling the truth and who's not. But then on the other hand, I think he was a product of his own time. He grew up, as I did, during the Cold War, and the whole idea was, you know, James Bond, okay? If you work for the government and if you work for the CIA, somehow or another, you're one of the guys. And so he just kept playing with them, kept dealing with them, you know, throughout his whole life. So in answer to your question, Jerry, yeah, I think he did. Played ball with him, but I think he also took a little bit of a grain of salt. But he felt like that. Yeah.
This is Richard here. I wanted to interrupt you, but I really wanted to ask you what you thought about Gordon's. Gordon and Dealey Plaza, Gordon and Dallas and JFK. What's going on with that? Because there were people who claimed that he was involved in others, and then Gordon. I asked him one time. And he just said no, but he never really wanted to lay that to rest, I thought. And I just wanted to know what you thought his involvement was.
He never wanted to lay that to rest. It's an interesting comment there, Richard.
a little
something to it. I did get him to it. Needless to say, because you know, one of my first big, you know. Fields of interest would be the Kennedy assassination, so I did go with it and try to nail him down. And he has pretty well convinced me that I don't believe he had anything to do with the Kennedy assassination.
I didn't think so either.
The main reason for that is, if he had, he wouldn't have lived this long, okay? He pretty much convinced me that he was at two shores in New York with Elizabeth Taylor, reportedly. The problem is that because he was mixed up in some of the things going on in New Orleans, connected to Clay Shaw and Guy Bannister and David Ferry, and he knew some of those people.
Yeah.
And that there was some interesting things. And I think basically the bottom line is that I think he understood a lot of what was happening. He like everybody else who actually had a direct connection to the assassination, they sensed, they knew, but they couldn't prove who did what, when, where, and how.
I just want to say, this is Carrie, that I just want to say, Jim, that I do think that he knew what happened, and I think he was an insider.
Sure.
In that world, I think he was very careful about revealing that. Bill Ryan, I asked you a question. I don't know if you got a chance to think about it or if you remember that incident where actually he did come in. That was the only time, and after all the years I've known him, that he actually acknowledged working, if you want to talk, with the CIA. I agree that he wasn't on the payroll. He didn't get money from them on a regular basis, but I can assure you he worked for them for all intents and purposes. That was the only time when he acknowledged.
He said it was a retainer that he was on, and a third party.
Okay. He did it at that time.
Technically, he wasn't an employee, but he was, you know.
Well, when he made this offer, I have to say, when he made the offer to the producer, he was acting on their behalf, very literally, and he had a conversation with the television producer for them on their behalf. And I don't know, Bill Ryan, do you remember that?
Yes, I do. I remember it pretty well. And it's clear to me that the employment lines in the agencies are not the same as they would be in a normal corporation. There are assets and there are relationships and there are assumptions, and there are unwritten exchanges and agreements. He was definitely involved in that network. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt about it whatsoever. And I agree with you completely, but he was always very cagey about what he would reveal. He was actually a very honorable man. I didn't know him nearly as well as quite a lot of the other people who were contributing his tribute, but I considered myself privileged to have met him a little bit back in 2006, 2007, when Project Camelot befriended him. And I'm sure you've mentioned this a dozen times already, later on the show, but Kerry's interview with him back in 2006, which he was very, very proud of, is one of Kerry's finest. And it really does give a good portrait of the man. And we enjoyed being with him, the time we spent with him. We were always had lots of fun with him. He was a good guy. He had a heart inside quite a gruff exterior. And his occasional bite was, his occasional bark was much, much, much worse than his bite ever was. And I think he was a very good man. Sorry to have lost him.
Well, let me interject something here real quickly. I have a question in the chat room, and it seems like one of the unknowns is a friend of Gordon's, and we don't know who it is. But they brought up a question, and it seems like Shmoopy, and I think you've read it, Angela, is somebody who knows Gordon.
I'll go ahead and read it if you like. The question says, from an unidentified individual, Gordon always said he had safeguards in terms of CDs with information in case anything had happened to him. Are any of you expecting something to happen to these, is the question.
Well, we've been talking about, I'd like other people to answer, but I do want to say right here, again, we mentioned, in case you weren't tuning in, a huge library. He had a very substantial UFO library that was, he said, the best in the world. That's how he termed it to me. Now, the CDs, I agree, he probably had safeguards out there. I have to say, Project Camelot didn't get one of those, to my knowledge. So I guess they're in other hands. I don't know. I do think Bill will appreciate this sort of description. I can see the CIA, pulling up in front of his residence, unloading, and loading the boxes, whatever he had coming through his stuff. I can see them doing that as we speak, as a matter of fact, unless someone has made prior arrangements. And I really wish that I had known he was going to be passing. Like I said, I would have been at his bedside to get his last statements. But I think if there are CDs out there, he probably was smart enough to give them to the right people.
I'd have to second that. I think it's entirely possible that he has some stuff stashed away. Now, I don't know about anybody else, but I'm not particularly waiting with bated breath to receive anything like that. But it wouldn't surprise me if something showed that.
Well, I would just add.
Yeah, I'm kind of with Jim on that. Gordon mentioned that several times, and naturally, if you were in Gordon's shoes, you would want people to think that you have information, so that that would be part of your safety net. And so it's a question of whether I really had it, but if he really had it, unfortunately, we don't know what the provisions are and where it is. Unfortunately, Kerry may be right. It may have already been carted away.
Yeah, I would just jump in here. This is Richard. And just, I suspect Gordon does have, he did mention to me that he had CDs worth of material. And
yeah,
the question is what actually is in it. I mean, with Gordon, he spoke in superlatives all the time. And, you know, I just...
I agree with that.
It's just how he was. And, you know, a lot of the times he would say certain things, I just knew it wasn't the case. Like, for example, he was constantly talking about how his computers were getting hacked. And when I saw him with his computers, he did not really have very good skills in operating his computers. I can just tell you that. And I just felt like really what he needed was someone with some tech skills to kind of to hook him up, and I think it never happened. But it was like that with Gordon. And regarding what he knew, he obviously had some very intense conversations with some very heavy inside people. And I do suspect that there is important information that's out there. That I think Kerry could be quite right that CIA or some agencies trying to scarf up right now if they haven't already. And I just wonder where. Gordon's friends were. If Sur is nearby, I think Sur is in Asia. Last time I kept track of any of this, so I don't really know who's. Yeah, I don't know who's got what of Gordon's material. Where the heck it even is?
Well, Rich, let me throw this in. I think this is really important to understand. First and foremost, I mean, he was a brilliant guy. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
And he really understood technical things. And as you said, he did hobnob with some very high-powered, knowledgeable people. But first and foremost, he was an entrepreneur. Okay? Always trying to get something going. Always trying to raise some money. And that goes all the way back to when he did one of his most proudest accomplishments, this World's Fair exhibit he did down in New Orleans as a very young man. And he kept trying to get things going like this now. With an entrepreneur and with that kind of person, you go up and you say, "Hey, how's it going?" They'd never come back and say, "Oh, I'm having a hard time with it. I can't seem to raise any money."
Really?
And no, it's always, everything's great. Everything's great. We got a big deal coming up. We got high-powered people involved. You know, it's going to be great. And I say this, and I'm not trying to belittle Gordon. This is the way you operate if you are a successful entrepreneur. And so I think there was an element of that in everything he said. A lot of times, I know there's some things I was involved in, and he would come out, and I would hear him flat tell people that he had the back end of the CIA. Well, he didn't have the back end of the CIA, but he had people connected with the CIA who were somewhat supportive. Because I think they were trying to pick his brain. They wouldn't know what he knew. But that doesn't mean that there was an actual locked-in signed contract business relationship.
Well, I have to say that, yeah, but I have to say that there was. I believe him on that. I actually think he had shown me documentation. I probably have it on my computer, as a matter of fact, that he sent me all kinds of stuff. And maybe I shouldn't be saying that because I guess the CIA is going to be at my door next time. But at any rate, I think that he definitely had a deal with at least a portion of the CIA. And you know, I've been told that the CIA has basically gone. What did they say? They've broken into the mainstream, and they've actually broken up. Unbeknownst to the people out there, so that when you talk CIA, you're not even talking about the same organization all the time. There are so many different factions.
Before we go any further, I need to inform you that at break, I'm going to hang up on all of you and Mike, the producer, will call you all back. We're having bandwidth issues right now, so they will call, he will contact all of you, and we will, have to reset this during the break. So I needed to give you a heads up on it. So go ahead, Jim.
Let me say one thing about what Jim and Kerry are talking about. I think they're both right. And you could say, well, how's that possible? And that's because the CIA is a very secretive organization, and I seriously doubt that the left hand knows what the right hand is doing many times. So his contacts there usually formally do a third party or whatever, and as far as I know, Ron Pandolfi was the only contact he really had that he made public. But Ron never really verified that. Of course, I only talked to him once or twice. Jim, have you ever made contact with Ron Pandolfi?
Yes, I've spoken to him on more than one occasion. My impression was that he was like so many others, including some of us, that we kept up with Gordon. We tried to help him out if we could. We were interested in what he was doing, but it was mostly just a monitoring thing. Let's just see what he's doing. You know, is it going to turn into anything?
And no doubt about it, Gordon was an entrepreneur. Jim's right about that. I never had a conversation with Gordon about anything unless he wanted some money.
He didn't come
to camp. But that doesn't mean he's wrong.
I agree with you completely. I'm a big Gordon North fan.
All right. Well, I have to say that someone asked in the chat whether he had the patents. He did. He said file patents on the ARV and something else to do with free energy. So he had definitely, I mean, he was very, very serious. He had worked with Ramsey Clark, actually. He didn't just know him. He worked for him. So people may not know that. He was very proud of his association with Ramsey Clark. And again, I want to stress people just, he was such a brilliant man. He actually said to me at one time that he felt very lonely at the top, so to speak. And I think he was actually not speaking from ego, and maybe Bill Ryan remembers this, where he actually said that he just didn't find very many people that were all that intelligent on planet Earth, and that he felt kind of like in a minority. And I think he really was puzzled by that. I mean, he wasn't talking from an ego standpoint. What do you think, Bill?
I can confirm that. I'd love to remember the exact quote. It's probably in our interview somewhere.
It was beautiful. Yeah, it was beautiful.
It's exactly what he said.
Yeah. I can certainly concur with that from my own interactions with Gordon. He's an extremely intelligent person. That's exactly right, Kerry. And you know, when you're that way out there, you're going to feel lonely. And Gordon, in particular, wasn't just extremely intelligent. He was just pushing past the boundaries of what ordinary people, you know, ordinary reality was for people. I had a couple of lunches with him in various diners. And I just remember it a lot of times, just stopping and looking around. And here's me and Gordon Novell sitting in a diner, just, you know, surrounded by a whole bunch of people who had no clue of what he was into. And I think that was Gordon's life. He was constantly right out there on the edge, and he knew.
I agree.
Yeah, I'm sitting here.
Yeah.
Well, let me chime in here. You know, the Gordon Novell that I remember was a flamboyant man and an extreme braggart, and I think he earned that right. One of the most highly opinionated people, and will tell you whether you liked it or not, what his opinions were. And, oh, we need to talk about this too. You know, his conflict, and I would love to get Jack Serfati on the line if I could, but I don't think that we'll be able to do it today.
Well, I think you should try, because I think he'd be willing to come on. Jack himself is just a flamboyant guy. I have to say, it's funny you mention his name, because I guess everyone was party to. I don't know if everyone got the emails, but I got the, you know, the discussions and the arguments that went on between Jack and Gordon, and these are just notorious. I think they're probably going to be go down in history. People who saved those as two men who would call each other names. Both of them being highly intellectual, at the same time, both of them being highly flamboyant. And one minute they hated each other's guts, and the next minute they loved each other to death and couldn't say enough nice things about each other. And this is one thing that was true of Gordon's personality, that he might love you one minute, he might hate you the next, but if he hated your guts and wanted to kill you, if you did something honorable in his eyes, he would change his opinion of you like in an instant and suddenly, you know, love you again.
Yeah.
That's right. Interesting about Jack and Gordon. They used to send me pictures of them with women having dinner. And it was kind of a one-upmanship. And it's kind of I've had my battles with somebody and still do. And I've had bad with Gordon, but they never were terminal, you know. In other words, he was always his friend. He would call you back.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, Jack used to tell us about everybody, including Gordon, that we weren't even wrong. We were less than wrong. Now, I don't know how you can be less than wrong, but, you know, that's Jack. You got to love him anyway. But Gordon and Jack.
You had two huge egos bumping heads, which was.
Yeah.
But he was told to work with Jack. Ron Pandolfi, the CIA, told him to work with Jack. That's what he told me. And so he had to be friendly with him. And he was grudgingly doing it for a while. But then he actually got to know Jack. I think he actually got to like him. In spite of himself, because you could tell by the email sort of discussion, and then he was just out of his mind. I mean, he just would rant on and on. I guess they also. I mean, the funny thing is, Gordon would go toe to toe with people like Hal Pudoff and Jack Sarfati on the technical. He didn't just let it ride.
You know, that's really true, and I always was amazed by that facet of Gordon, because Hal Pudoff and Sarfati are not just regular physicists, they're famous and incredibly accomplished. Gordon was not a physicist, but he was never afraid to do it exactly as you said, just to go right up there and argue his case for his torsion field physics model, and I had always had a hard time following a lot of the arguments. I would glean them, I think, like probably a lot of us did. And went right in there and just argued his case.
I don't know about you, Richard, but I understood that about as much as I understand Star Trek's warp drive.
Yeah. I mean, I've been trying to get up to speed over the last few years, but especially when you and I were dealing particularly with Gordon. It was a struggle for me scientifically, I will be honest with you, to try to follow the nuances of what he was talking about when it came to anti-grav and avionics. And I know that Paul Richard Price here has studied this quite a bit. and I'm sure many listeners know this very well, but for me, coming into the field, coming into the argument at that time, was a challenge. And I have to thank Gordon, honestly and truly, for opening my horizons on a lot of this technology. And I had many, many discussions with Gordon about a lot of things, but he was one of the people who really kept pushing me to continually broaden my own take on this whole phenomenon, particularly technically, to gain technical skills and knowledge about a lot of this.
Well, he certainly explained it to me in the discussions we had to where it made sense. And in a general way, I understood what he was saying, and it made a lot of sense. And I'll never forget one thing that really got me going on this was he just said, he once told me early on that he said, you know, galaxies rotate. And so I immediately got a picture of, you know, these huge swirls that are the galaxies. And I'm going, yeah. And he says, what makes them move?
Richard and Jen.
I love that.
We are about to go on break, and Richard has to leave. Now, Jim, and I'm sorry I'm interrupting you. We have about 1 minute left until break, so I have to kind of close it down. And Richard, thank you again for joining the roundtable.
Well, it was a pleasure. I wish it had been under different circumstances. You know, my interactions with Gordon were, as I said before Jim came on, I said, you know, Gordon, I loved him, and he'd make me crazy at the same time, but I will really miss that, and I'm happy to be here. I'm just sorry that it was under these circumstances.
Well, maybe we can get you back on the show later on in more pleasant circumstances, Richard, and I do appreciate you joining in today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, and Jim, I'd like for you to finish the discussion after break, and they will try to call you back. Okay, Jim?
Okay, so I hang up and they're coming again.
Oh, yeah, and Nighthawk will be contacting you, the producer. And
okay, now, Richard, I'm going to give you about another 30 minutes, okay?
Not a problem, Jim. Not a problem at all. That'll work.
Okie doke. All right, I'm getting off then, and I'll wait for the call.
Okay, thank you, Jim.
All right, bye-bye.
Goodbye. And we're going to try to see if we can get also Jack Sarfati online to talk about his story with Gordon Novell, which is quite a colorful one, if I'm correct. And let's just say we will be coming back in shortly with the Paul Richard Price Show, the extended version, with my roundtable of Jerry Pippin Now, Gary Cassidy, Bill Ryan, and Jim Mars, and we will try to even get Jeff Roddy on. Okay, Jim, could you continue, please, the what you were trying to discuss with us about the Gordon and Jack situation before the break?
Oh, well, I mentioned, I think everybody agreed with me that what you saw there was a clash between two huge egos. You see it all the time. But I think both Jack and Gordon down deep had a respect for each other. Gary, wouldn't you agree?
Oh, yeah, I would definitely say so. In fact, Bill Ryan, you haven't said much, but I think, you know, because you have a grasp of the physics, weren't you rather impressed with Gordon's ability to go toe-to-toe with these guys like Pudoff and Sarfati with regard to the science? I mean, he never stepped back.
Yeah, absolutely. Gordon was fearless in almost everything he did, and that included taking on Sarfati and Hal Pudoff on their own home ground. And it was always fun to watch the online battles that took place. I would very much welcome Jack Sarfati joining us if he's able to, if we can get hold of him somehow. My guess is that Jack would be a real gentleman, because I think like two football players in the Super Bowl, they would tackle each other as hard as they possibly could do, and then they'd have a beer afterwards. And I don't think that there was any personal animosity there It was all professional pride, and it was battling over the details of the extremely refined physics that they were debating. But I would very much like to give Jack the opportunity to say a few words, and I think that he would be very, very kind.
Yeah, Bill, on a different subject while we're waiting to hear from Jack, I'd like to know more, if possible, about this pilot that you and Carrie did with Gordon and why it never aired. I mean, what happened?
If you can get to the bottom of that, we would appreciate it.
So it's just kind of dribbled away, huh?
Well, I missed the first part of the show when this may have been discussed, and so I'm probably going to repeat what Kerry has already said, but it contained a lot of very heavy-duty stuff. We had Bob Dean on there at his very finest, talking for 5 minutes on what would have been mainstream television about how the president of the U.S. doesn't know what's going on. And as a highly respectable elder statesman representing the retired military, for a lot of people who'd never heard such things being said before on television, his words would have had a lot of weight. And it's entirely possible that somebody said, you know what, this is just too sensitive and we can't let this air. I'd be very interested to know whether, Kerry, you've already spoken to that on the air before I joined in the show here.
No, I didn't talk too much at length about it. I did say the little anecdote where Gordon made them an offer, like I said, they shouldn't refuse, saying that they would make it a well-known it would be a successful show if they accepted. I'm thinking that maybe they should have accepted the offer that the CIA run the show. But the bottom line is it didn't go anywhere. It went on the shelf, and it might be partially because of that. Do we have Jack? I gave them a number I have for Jack on the – I hear the phone ringing. Did we get Jack Sarfati?
No. We're going to try it again, but you might want to, if you can, if you have a cell phone or any other way to contact them, let them know about
this. All right.
So you met us.
Okay, I'll do that.
You know how
You know, about the television projects, I talked to Gordon several times about doing a couple of pilots, and they just kind of floated away. But Gordon was very interested in getting this message out on television, but it just never seemed to get there. You know, your interview with Gordon, Carey, is probably a classic. We did a pretty good interview with him as well. But they were few and far between, even though he was very accessible. We just never really got together on ground rules or whatever. And
well, I think that's, you know, he was accessible in sort of a superficial way. But the bottom line is they were very particular. As I mentioned, they did vet the interview, although, like I said, also, and Bill will appreciate this, that they couldn't very well say, take this out, because the minute you take something out, we know damn well it's true, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And this is always their problem. But the bottom line is they had a handler in the room while he was doing the interview, which tells you how careful they were being with us and with the interview. There's just no doubt about that. So Gordon was accessible on one level, and on another level, he was very guarded.
True.
Well, Jim, chime in if you would, please, and let us know what you think about this.
About what? I do agree with Kerry that he was very open about a lot of things and pretty close to the chest about others. And again, he wanted to maintain his connections with CIA and other groups and the physicists and everybody else, and yet at the same time try to bring all this out. Now, that's a pretty delicate tightrope walk, you know.
It's true. And he more than once told me, just like he's told you, Jim, that he didn't work for the CIA. He worked actually, he said, down in the garrison thing when he was doing the little dirty tricks here. he actually is working for somebody in the White House. That's what he told me. Did he tell you that?
Yeah, told me the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's possibly true. And again, let's not forget, we're talking about Gordon's life here. I think the Gordon Novell that was a hotshot boy entrepreneur, getting his kicks by hobnobbing with the CIA and the anti-Castro Cubans and the White House and all the political stuff that was going on back in the 60s and 70s, I don't think that's the exactly the same Gordon Novell that we knew in the late 90s and through the 2000s.
Yeah, I think you're right. One thing I've always regarded, I never got to ask him if he knew Chase Brandon. because of Chase's book and all of that, and the fact that he worked in Hollywood as a liaison for the CIA, and we could say all we wanted to say about Gordon, but he was still starstruck. Showbiz was in his blood.
Yeah, that's true. And I don't guess y'all have even mentioned the suit he had going about going after the estate of Billy Rose.
Mm-hmm.
Just sorry to break in here. Just want to let you know, I did leave a message for Jack Sarfati. The phone did ring through to a message machine. So if he gets the message, I've had him call me back on my cell. If he does, I'll put into my chat whatever you want me to have him do, and we'll see if we can add him. I don't know if he's going to get the message or not.
Well, let me interject a comment from the chat room here. What progress had Gordon made on his starport concept? And maybe Carrie and Jim or Bill, maybe one of the three of you or even Jerry can chime in on what kind of ideas you may have heard from Gordon on the progress he may or may not have made on starport concept.
Well, Gordon never really talked to me too much about that. I'm probably the only one in this group that was more interested in the clandestine parts of Gordon Novell's life than the technical things and this anti-gravity, for lack of a better term, that he had. Gordon was ate up with it. I mean, he believed in it wholeheartedly. And he might have had the answers. And we do know that the good old boys down in Jim's area, in my area here in Oklahoma, and down in Texas, they're not very friendly to the idea of free energy.
Now that's a huge story, going back all through the 20th century, that the suppression of energy. Whether free energy or just cheap energy, it doesn't matter. It's really amazing. All you have to do is just watch the gasoline prices, and when everything's goes down, when nobody's buying, and it gets to be summertime and vacation time, and it goes up. So, you know, I think I'm reminded of a cartoon where the oil executives are throwing darts at a dartboard, you know. $4.95, okay. You know, and they just pick it that way. But I think Gordon's idea, the thing is, again, back to the entrepreneur aspect of him. I know I was trying to keep up. He was preparing, and in fact, I helped him prepare proposals to God, everybody from, I don't know, everybody from Henry Kissinger on down, because he was trying to get somebody to get behind his energy program. He said, this is how we can make everybody in the world wealthy, okay? Because if you have your own energy and you don't have to worry about energy, well, you can grow crops and you can make clothes, you can do all kinds of things, and you're not going to be just a consumer slave. And he would go to these groups. There would be meetings. People would look at it. Everybody would go, yay, yay, Ray. But then just, you know, mysteriously doors would close. Nothing would happen, and he would move on to his next attempt at trying to get funding. But this is one of the problems and dichotomies of today's world. If you have something that's going to be a medical breakthrough or an energy breakthrough or whatever,
And to make it effective, you need money, okay? And yet when you go to the people who have the types of money that it would take to actually produce, distribute, publicize something of that magnitude, hey, they don't want to shake up their status quo. They don't want to give up the money they've already got for the chance that there might be better money up ahead. So it's really a strange thing. But he just kept at it right up to the end.
Yeah, and I think Gordon was well aware of this dichotomy, as you put it, Jim. And, you know, it's, and I made some comments about Gordon always asking for money. Well, you have to have money to do your projects. I mean, there's no doubt about it. There's nothing wrong with that.
Right. You know, that's a double-edged sword of people, you know, I've heard people claim that I write books just to make money. You know, well, I try to explain, hey, the New York Times publishes news, but, you know, is it because they're just want to be philanthropic and give us news? No, it's so they can sell advertising so they can make money. You know, unfortunately, it's all about money. Yeah, you know, you'd be as philanthropic as you want to be, but at the end of the day, you got to pay your bills just like everybody else, so everybody has to figure out.
Absolutely. Well, let me say.
I'm sure Carrie and Bill understand that better than anybody. I know both, and I know that both of them have been doing what they want to do out of a love for truth and trying to get truth out. But at the end of the day, both Bill and Carrie, they got to pay their bills. So they got to figure out some way to do what they want to do, need to do, desire to do, and yet make a little money at the same time.
What's important to remember here, this is a conversation that Carrie and I had with Hal Puthoff himself. It was a few years ago, and this was early on in the days of Camelot. And as everyone knows, Hal Puthoff's been around for quite a long time, and he's deeply connected himself, and he very, very gently advised us. He said, never try to prove anything. He says, you can write about UFOs, you can write about free energy, you can write about all this stuff as much as you like. You start publishing documents or building devices or showing that you've got a UFO in your garage that's actually going to fly, then come down heavy. And many free energy inventors, many people like Otis Carr way back in the early 1960s who actually did something that was bad, they were stomped on pretty damn hard. In the meantime, right, the powers that be don't mind people talking about stuff as long as that's all that they do. And Gordon was trying to do more than that.
Yes.
Well, along those lines, let me tell you that I do recall now, it's coming back to me, that the last time I talked to Gordon, and I can't remember when that was. I guess it wasn't that long ago because he wasn't sick though, I have to say. But he was about to go to, I have to say, he was about to go to the Arabs with his ideas. Mm-hmm. He was getting fed up. And, I mean, he would talk to anybody. He would talk to the Chinese. He would talk. I mean, he was a patriot. Don't get me wrong. But on the other hand, he was a businessman. And he wanted to see this come to the world. And I know he was getting frustrated, as he did at time from time to time, because, like I said, I also think that they were playing him as a patsy. And I told him to his face this many times. And but the bottom line is that I think he was about to go to the Arabs. I think he wanted to go talk to some people. I don't know if it was in Iran or wherever. Now, this could be the reason why he suddenly had a bad turn of health. This is the kind of thing that goes on. You know, we don't know what really went on there. And I just know his drive. This is a man that was incredibly driven. If he could stay alive, he would. I can't believe that he's actually passed on so quickly at this point. You know, all of us have to go at some point for sure. And we do choose our times. I appreciate that. But I have to say that Gordon, even to this moment, I'm sure he's fighting mad that he's been pushed out of the game.
Yeah.
You know, because
yeah.
It's just the way he was.
Well, Jim, you know, you're going to have to leave at the top of the hour, and before we have to go into commercial break, I want to thank you again for coming in and for joining in on the phone call, Jim.
Yeah, I'm going to have to leave too here. I have an appointment coming up.
Well, I appreciate it. I think we'll speak for all of us. So that Gordon Novell was a really fascinating character, and I think, in fact, I told him he went. See, there's again, he went around and told everybody I was going to be his official biographer. Well, hey, I never signed anything on that. I never even agreed to that. But what I will say, and I said to him, I said, look, nobody's going to be able to write a truthful biography of you until you have passed from the scene, because you're going to be there looking over their shoulder and tell them, no, it's this, it's that, it could be this, and it might have been that. So I look forward to, as the months and years go by, I think we're going to begin to get a broader and probably more truthful view of our Gordon Novell. And I look forward to it, because he was a fascinating person.
Well, are you going to actually write the... Are you going to actually write the biography now, Jim?
I don't have any plans to do that at this moment, but who knows?
Things can change here, Paul, immediately. Never know. Jim's absolutely right about the thing that we didn't mention, and we should have, is Gordon was a PR genius as well.
Yes.
And he knew the value of Jim Mars's name, and he knew the value of being on certain talk shows. Now, there's nothing wrong with that at all. And that's how he got to where he got to where he is on this project, which was against multi-billion-dollar corporations. He still was making progress.
That's right.
Don't you agree? I mean, he knew how to play everybody.
So now, without him playing, maybe we'll find out what's really going on and what really needs to be done about this. I just want to say I hope somebody continues his work with the torsion field energy project. I think it has a lot of merit. I think people who are smarter than I am and know physics more than I do might be able to actually figure it out and it could usher in a whole new day on this planet.
Well, I bet that you're going to use his plans. I have to say that he was also a very classic top executive in the sense, and Rich Dolan will appreciate this, although he's not on this call now. He knew how to select a really crack team, and he knew how to go out and basically kind of wine and dine and persuade and get those people to work together. And he was a true leader in that sense. That's a unique quality. A lot of leaders don't know how to choose a team. They tend to choose people that are dumber than them, and that's always the wrong thing to do. Gordon knew the actual principle of leading a team, which is to hire people that are really brighter than you in every area. So that you are then and the project has a better chance of success. And that's really, he wasn't going to stand on ceremony. He almost had ego in the right places. I would be one to say that, because he knew when to step back. He knew when to bring the right person forward. And he at the same time went toe to toe with them. So he was a very good leader in that respect.
Well, and one more thing, we still have time, and we only have about a minute or so left before the break. Let me thank Jim and Jerry both for spending some good time with us, discussing their recollections of Gordon Novell, his flamboyance, and his ultimate agenda, and that was to ram alien technology into the forefront using any means possible. I mean, and I use the term ram, pardon me, quite literally, and that was part of the name of what he used. Too bad, though, he won't be here to finish the work. And hello, and thank you again for staying on air right now with the extended edition of the Paul Richard Christ Show. And now my remaining guest is Bill Ryan and Jerry Cassidy. And we're discussing Gordon Novell, the man, the myth, the legend. And Bill, it's been a while since you and I have talked one-on-one. Tell me, altogether, what are your recollections? Do you think that his work will continue, or do you think that it'll be shut down for good from this point on? Who do you think, both you and Carrie can answer this, who do you think will pick up the mantle?
Well, as I was saying maybe about 10 minutes ago, just before the break, one of the problems here faced by anybody who's trying to put something out there in the real world in physical operational form is that, as any free energy developer will tell you, then they face a whole different series of challenges. They're not just theoretical challenges or funding challenges or trying to get a team together challenges. They're actually faced with that if the powers that be, or whatever we want to call them, don't want something to physically manifest, they want it to be produced, they want something to fly, then they're going to do whatever it takes to get in the way of that entire enterprise. And Gordon never stopped pushing, as everyone has been saying in the last hour or two. But what I remember is ever since 2006, right up in the last 5 or 6 years, he would always try, he'd always get setbacks, he was always getting interfered with. There would be all manner of obstacles in his way. And I think that you've got to be a pretty exceptional chief executive, let us say, as Kerry was saying earlier, to actually push through all of that and make something work when you've got all the vested interests who are operating against him. And I think that's a pretty hard act to follow. I don't know whether we're going to have any UFOs flying in someone's garage anytime soon. It hasn't happened yet. And it would take a lot of money, and I think some kind of a tacit go-ahead from the agenda holders in order to permit this to happen. And I don't know whether we're there yet.
Okay, and we have a question off topic right now from the chat room. Bill, have you had any contact with Charles in 2012? And how is his ground crew doing in? Is it Volacamba?
Okay. There's two separate questions there. No, I haven't had any contact with Charles for over a year. I have no idea what he's up to. And that was the brief answer to a potentially much longer one, which is probably beyond the scope of any radio show. And I'm currently in Ecuador, as a lot of people know. I had dinner with George Green last night. He's here also. And there are a lot of people now who are gradually moving out of the States as their circumstances permit. This is a much safer place to be in, measured against a whole variety of counts. And I'm not the only person who believes that that we may see a lot of changes in North America during the course of the next 6 to 9 months. And I admire Kerry's view, if Kerry's still there, which I believe is pretty much to hold the front line, right where the front line may need to be held. And what we're doing here in Ecuador is, I guess it's what George Green would have called a ground crew operation. We're getting together a whole bunch of people, and we're preparing as a backup plan, if you like, for what happens if anything else in the rest of the world might go down.
Well, and one thing I'm going to interject here, and it'll be a statement then followed with that will be a question, Bill and Kerry, and I want you both to chime in if you would. I believe one of the main reasons why we're not going to see the Flux liner or any current technologies based on that model ever released to the public, it goes back to the paradigm dealing with Alternative 3 and how... And you brought up Earth changes, Bill. I agree with that. I believe, and I've written in my new book, Redemption, the Prophecy Chronicles, the Final Chronicle, about the interaction with Nibiru, or even with Nemesis, Planet X, if you would, with the Earth-Sun environment, and how that could create catastrophic Earth changes that might end up becoming an extinction level event. And what I believe is that these secret societies already know that this is about to occur, and that they have prepared for it for years, and that they have prepared for it using technologies such as ARV to develop ways of getting off planet while the getting is good, and recolonizing in other parts of the solar system, you know, planetoid, planetary bodies, planets per se, before these Earth changes would be brought in, would be catastrophic enough that a majority of mankind may not survive. And I want your input on it. What do you think? Do you think that they're using these technologies to get off planet while they still have time?
Well, it's a fascinating topic, and there is evidence out there. A little while ago, I collected 6 or 7 data points that suggested the fairly extraordinary idea that the elite of the planet, the people who really believe that they're running the show and who kind of own the place, are actually preparing to bail out. There's quite a lot of circumstantial evidence that's surfaced over the years that they're preparing to jump ship and go elsewhere. And it can't be proven. One of the big questions that a lot of people in the alternative media have been discussing for years now is, I mean, it's unquestioned that ever since the early 1950s, trillions of dollars have been spent in the development of what Rich Dolan called a breakaway civilization. There's an enormously high technology in the underground bases, not only in North America, but in Europe and Russia and China. And there's something that the elite of the world seem to know that we certainly don't. And what we don't know is whether they're preparing for something that they know will happen, or that they feel they know will happen, or that they're concerned might happen, and this is just kind of standard military defensive thinking. My own point of view is that they're guarding against something which they think might happen, but they don't actually know whether it's going to play out or not. For example, a little while back, Kerry and I were contacted. October 2007, October 2007. Sorry, it was either 2007, 2008. I think it was 2007. We were contacted by somebody who anyone listening to this show would recognize the name of. This is a Disclosure Project witness who currently was working with a top secret security clearance for the Department of Homeland Security. And one is legitimately entitled to ask the question, why would a rocket scientist be working for the Department of Homeland Security with a top secret clearance? And this man told us that we should prepare basically for not only for an abrupt geomagnetic pole reversal, and there's evidence that this is actually starting to happen right now. A lot of people are tracking this. This is in the real world and can be tracked in the public domain. But also that there would be a corona mass ejection, one or more corona mass ejections of the same scale as the 1859 Harrington event. And I contacted this guy again back in March of this year to ask him for an update. And after I sent him 3 emails, to my astonishment, he replied, and he confirmed his original data. And what he said was very interesting, and to me it was very plausible. He said that the current estimate was that there would be a major event of the scale of the Carrington event, the Carrington event, or more, or larger. And this was, the current estimate of timing was December or January coming, and that it was not known whether or not this would disrupt the power grid and the internet and communications grid to the extent that it possibly could. They didn't know what effects this was going to cause, but they're expecting this. And the note of plausibility for me about this was that they did not know exactly what was going to happen, but they were bracing themselves and preparing themselves for something, and the public is not being told. Of course, there are mainstream articles now being published increasingly, and this is even surfacing in the mainstream media, that the solar cycle is about to peak in the next 6 months or so, and maybe something unusual is going to happen. And it seems to me, let's just be cautious about this, it seems to me to be credible information, and it seems to me prudent that we should prepare for this in some sensible way. The joke that this source actually wrote in his email, he said, you better get a lot, he said, it's going to get very hot. He said, better get a lot of sunblock or better still go underground. Now, that was a joke, but he was basically trying to say that there was something here which we should be paying attention to and which we shouldn't overlook. And I personally am taking this fairly seriously.
And, Carrie, are you currently there?
Yes.
Okay, would you... The question I have for both of you is, it goes to the Planet X or Nibiru hypothesis. Now, we have a large mass, ground dwarf in size, interacting with the Earth, Sun, space. Its gravimetric, or the gravity that it exerts on both the Sun and the Earth would be sufficient enough to create large coronal mass ejections. So are we looking at them confirming that Bill and Kerry, either one of you go ahead and chime, that maybe that the Nibiru hypothesis is correct?
Well, first of all, let me reply to a couple of the things Bill has referenced, because I have to agree with him that witness was someone substantial who should know what he's talking about. And I agree. I think Bill will also acknowledge that Henry Deacon had told us years in advance of anyone else, actually, about this potential event that would knock the grid down. In fact, it is in the video that I show people when I speak, basically a portion of the United States getting blacked out. And that is what Dan Sherman was hired to do as a precog. As someone who is able to communicate with various groups of aliens telepathically, he was trained to be there during that time. Now, he defected from his position, but there is no guarantees, I have to say, and I think he even acknowledged during the interview, or at least off the camera, off the record, that and I know I can say this much, that there's every possibility that should this happen, that not only are other precogs put in those positions, and no doubt there would have been many of them, but that they may tap him to come back into the fold, so to speak, in the interest of humanity, if you want to call it that. And so this is the kind of thing we're looking at. Yes, it's a high possibility, although I do recall Henry Deacon also said that it could be a pulse beam weapon or something else of another nature. In other words, that even if this didn't happen as a result of a solar flare, it may be something that they cause on purpose. Just because it suits their agenda. So we're always looking at those aspects. In other words, what's going to be natural and what's going to be helped along to go in whatever way that the various groups that are at war with each other, as well as let's say the masses of humanity, what they want. So I would say that. Now, as far as the Nibiru thing, there are many different perspectives. Again, I interviewed Andy Lloyd. He spent 10 years researching this from a scientific point of view. And the general consensus, even as Henry Deacon said, in and across the various intelligence agencies and defense industry, at least in above top secret, is that there is a brown dwarf second sun that is part of our solar system that does come through and does have planets rotating around it. Now, whether that planet is going to come through at this time and whether it will come close enough to make a difference, I don't know. There are different perspectives on that. I do know that there have also been told, I've been told by back channel people, that there are other bodies in our solar system of which we are not aware and not told about. And one or two of those may be planetoids on the way in, and they could be disruptive. So this is where you get into a whole conjecture about what's coming in, et cetera, et cetera. And I know that there was a comet that was recently discovered that they actually made an announcement about that's also on the way in. Whether that will do anything or not, I don't know. There definitely seemed to be something in the area of the Oort cloud, from what I understand, which is pretty far out there, but nonetheless could be perturbing the planets in our solar system and interacting with our sun. In fact, Planet X could be a lot closer than we think. It could actually, if it is a planet that is on its own trajectory. Now, whether it's part of this group that goes around the brown dwarf, I don't know. This is where it gets very, very confused. The Antarctica telescopes, the interaction with Antarctica, with various things going on there, heavy-duty emphasis right now down there could be an indicator that there's something up. You know, there's some body being photographed constantly in the sky. I get photos all the time. They're showing us something. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's this body we're talking about. Bill, do you have a perspective? I imagine you do on this.
Yeah, sure. It's something which, like yourself, I've been following for quite a number of years. One of the things that Henry Deacon told us, as you remember very clearly, he said the problem is that everything's happening at once. Not only have you got plans for World War III, you've got all kinds of orchestrated financial collapse, you've got something is happening to the sun at the moment, as we were talking earlier, and there are a number of potential reasons for that. And one of the things is that the whole electromagnetic balance of the solar system, just to put it really crudely, is being perturbed by the presence of a large incoming object. And a lot of people have been talking about this for quite a while. Dr. Bill Deagle, who we both know pretty well, has been speaking about this for years. So is Andy Lloyd, who I greatly respect. You did a good interview with him, and I greatly respect his research. My own position about this, as best I know, is that it's not anywhere close, but it's probably out there around about the orbit of Jupiter. It's coming this way. It's probably radiating in the infrared, which means that it's not visible yet by the kind of optical telescopes that amateur astronomers would have. But if it were anywhere closer, like going to appear, you know, in the next few months, then the amateur astronomers all over the world would already be able to see that. And they would be screaming from the rooftops about it, even if only for the very prosaic reason that every amateur astronomer has as a sort of secret personal objective to be able to name a major heavenly body for the first time that they have themselves discovered. And so there's a lot of personal ambition involved in the world of amateur astronomy. They're very competitive with each other about discovering new asteroids, new objects of any kind. And something as significant as a binary companion to our sun no one's going to shut anybody up if they actually were, if it was out there to be seen by them. And this has not happened. And this means, in my own consideration, that it's nowhere close. Bob Dean told us in an interview that he gave with us, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, that his own inside sources said that it was probably going to swing in around about 2017. And from the jigsaw pieces of information that I've been able to put together, this is probably about right. This isn't going to happen anytime soon, like in the next kind of year or two. I think we've got a whole different set of problems to face in the immediate future. But I think that Planet X will be swinging by later on. It's not going to hit the planet or anything like this, but it's certainly going to be spectacular. That's the best I've got at the moment. And Kerry, I would love to ask you whether you broadly agree with what I've just said or whether you've got any extra perspectives on that.
Well, yeah, the interesting idea about Jupiter, there being a planet in the vicinity of Jupiter, like I said, it is possible, again, because I get different stories from different people, and I don't know what's going on with you, Bill, and actually I haven't talked to Bill in, 6 months or something, so I've got no idea what he's been up to, et cetera, et cetera, but I do have constant contact with various, sources and whistleblowers and so on, and, I am getting information, but it's interesting to me that the Planet X story, so if you want to call it that, has been so guarded and so heavily influenced by disinfo and cross signals. And whenever something is like that, I mean, you have to look at it and find it very fascinating. I don't know if that means it's true. I certainly know that our car was broken into, if you recall, at Milan Airport after we just interviewed Luca Scantamburlo. They were obviously searching. They didn't take any money or credit cards or anything else that were in plain view. They were searching for what they hoped was evidence that was given to Luca by Barbato, Cristoforo Barbato. If people remember the story of the Jesuit priest who disclosed information to Cristoforo, the journalist Cristoforo Barbato. All of this is on our Luca Scantamburlo interview, which I highly recommend if you have questions about this whole story. I mean, I can't believe the Camelot interviews are just, and I know that sort of sounds like I'm tooting my own horn, but you have to understand that from our perspective, we're as much sort of watching the interviews as participating in them. So I just find them to be a fascinating historical document that basically covers almost every question out there in a really amazing manner. But to kind of wrap this up so it doesn't become a lecture, let me just say that I think that's evidence, if you remember, that certainly the Italian government and quite possibly the Vatican were extremely concerned about evidence of Planet X now or something. And so I just can't discount that. I also can't discount the fact that after that happened and after the disclosure by Cristoforo Barbato, you know for a fact, Bill, that he couldn't get a job. He became unemployable. He was blacklisted. The number of things that have gone on, and then the Vatican telescope, there is no doubt whatsoever of the Vatican's obsession with having a telescope here in the U.S., I think it's heavily guarded. It just put out some recent information that sort of validated that again. It's pretty much old information, but it's still very important and very interesting. So something's going on with it, but again, it's just not clear what.
Well, yeah. Bill, it's about time for us to go on our final break now, this extended show. Before we get into the discussion, though, Angela, you're there in the background. I would like you to field this question yourself for them since you edited the newest version of the book. So,
yes, I had the honor of editing the book Sands of Time. So the new version does have a more of a a grammatically correct situation, but it certainly didn't take away from the book for me. Anyway, the question that comes from the chat is, has anyone in this panel read Sands of Time? And then the second part of that question is, if so, have they tried to bring the concept that Sean alludes to in his book regarding PX being used as a ruse to conceal the alien armada? Okay, so that's a pretty heavy question. I don't know.
I've read the book, and then I've actually been instrumental in getting that book sold.
So, I know you have, as a matter of
fact.
Much, yes,
absolutely, have read the book, and highly recommend it. On top of it, it is from a whistleblower testimony, and I believe Sean did his best to reveal all of that in a work of apparent
fiction,
mm-hmm. even though it is actually very nonfiction in many, many ways, and he did a very good job in that regard.
I thought so too, Carrie. I really did. I kind of walked away from the book just like everyone else, kind of changed a little bit as a person, you know, looking back, you know, with him bringing it all together in that book. I really was impressed and was honored to be able to throw my two cents in with the editing. But anyway, please continue.
Carrie, what I'd like to do is just to clarify this with our listeners. Gordon used to talk about stuff like alien invasions, about even a fake alien invasion scenario, and how that the elite may have used this type of technology, not only to fake or to do what Dr. Carol Rosen talked about, but also to get off planet while they still had an opportunity before these particular Earth changes occurred. And why I brought up that point was the fact to help people understand Gordon, you have to allow them to be able to see from the perspective, Gordon's mind's eye, his perspective on things. And that's why I wanted to discuss the Planet X hypothesis and the other things that we've talked about, because Gordon used to talk about this quite often.
Well, I agree with that. And this is a tribute to Gordon, so we don't want to get too far off topic either. But the person who wrote the question in the chat was asking, was actually talking about... referring to Sean David Morton's statement that Planet X could be hiding an armada of a fleet of ships on the way here, sort of an ET or alien invasion scenario, if you will. And I have to say that sort of sounds very blue beamish to me on the one hand. But on the other hand, Sean and I shared a knowledge and interaction with the writer of the Wingmakers saga, which talks about a race of robots that could very well be on the way here. I know that we are dealing with other things as well. Obviously, we're dealing with an invasion that's already happened, and that's a very important caveat to what Sean is saying. The other thing is that if it is hiding, in other words, if they're making a big deal out of Planet X to hide an armada on the way here, that's kind of a strange way to do it. I do know that some of the planetoids that have been on the way in have actually come and gone. The recent asteroids that were, from what I understand, planetoids actually, could have contained, in other words, beings inside them. They use these things as craft, and they can actually manipulate them and propel them, and thereby, because it's kind of like a ship, if you can envision that, then they can have beings inside, and they could, you know, they could be dropping beings off, and we wouldn't even know it. This is where people criticize Hoagland, but there may be truth behind a lot of the so-called madness or things that don't seem to have happened yet, and yet we are actually looking at a planet that is inundated by various races that are here with agendas of their own, and that may, some of which are hostile. And in fact, this situation off in the Pacific right now, regardless of whether you believe that's really going on, certainly did go on and has gone on, hidden from view of the general public. There are wars, various wars going on behind our, sort of above in our skies, above the chemtrails, and in our oceans. And UFOs do get shot down by our government and maybe by other races in using their own ships and so on. So it's a complex story, and that's my answer to the question that was put into the chat. Bill, do you want to give that a stab?
Yeah, sure, thanks. For me, the idea of any incoming planetary object conceding an armada of UFOs is ludicrous, I have to say. I mean, that's the kind of thing you put in a Hollywood movie. If the ETs are doing that, then they've got very low technology. They're moving very, very slowly, and they clearly don't have a lot of room for choice. And that's those aren't the ETs which I understand are out there. They can appear, they can disappear, they can travel halfway across the universe simply by using wormhole technology. They can do absolutely anything they want to. And this is one of the problems, just to jump halfway sideways here into what Zechariah Sitchin was always saying about the Anunnaki and Nibiru. The idea that the Anunnaki, who are a space-faring, high-technology race, capable of landing on this planet any time they wanted to, besides engaging in any kind of genetic and cultural manipulation that they wish to, hanging on to an icy planetoid, waiting patiently for thousands of years until it came in from the Oort cloud. I mean, this is ridiculous. You know, they can do anything they want to. They have high technology. We heard ourselves from Henry Deacon how you can get in an elevator called a jump room. You press a sequence of codes on a control panel.
Hello?
And then you're on Mars. Yeah.
Bill, hold 1 second with you. Yes, caller? Hello? Okay, I'm sorry about this. I guess they hung up. Holy cow, what happened? We got disconnected. You guys hear me in there? I do apologize for that. I think we got disconnected from the caller.
Anytime you feel someone important is trying to get in there. In the meantime, just to round off what I was saying, any high technology race of ETs worth their salt can do absolutely anything they want to at any time, and they're certainly not dependent upon planetary orbital physics to hide behind. They can appear, they can disappear, they can manifest, they can warp space and time, they can do anything they like. And so I suspect that that was something that Sean David Morton was saying pretty much tongue-in-cheek, just as what Hollywood would appreciate is a good movie theme. And that was always the problem with things like NMN, and I have to say that I think Hoagland got himself into some intellectually pretty deep water when he was hypothesizing without any grounds whatsoever. But they are out. I mean, just to support what Kerry was saying in a positive way, there are hostile ETs. That is, for me personally, that is a given. I'm sure that there are all kinds of games going on out there. Some might call them battles. I think that Planet Earth is a much prized piece of real estate. And I suspect that the life forms on Planet Earth are much prized for other purposes as well, and the human race may be much prized as well, and may even be considered that it is owned. There may be a competing states for who feels that they are in charge here. And we probably only have about 5% of a very, very, very large picture. Regarding Project Bluebeam, for lack of a better word, I don't know if it was ever actually called that, something that Gordon, I think, would certainly agree with, and this is to bring this story arc back to Gordon's own interests. We heard from Henry Deacon when we were talking about the possibility of a fake alien invasion being manifested using some kind of a laser light show out there, some kind of a high-tech holographic imagery out there in the skies. Henry just said, listen, you have no idea how many craft the secret government have.
they could fill the skies with these things and everyone would think they were alien craft. You wouldn't even need a laser show. They're physical objects and they've got this whole armada themselves that they can fake anything that they like with. One of the stories that we heard from Gordon Novell, we didn't hear this personally. We talked to him about it a little bit, but he went live on this when he was talking with George Knapp on Coast to Coast. I think it was in January 2010. He said that that the nephew of a good friend of his, who is a very experienced hiker, was out in the Utah desert, 25 miles away from the nearest road, in the middle of nowhere. And Gordon was very graphic in the way that he described this. He says you couldn't even get a horse there. There are big boulders. There are rattlesnakes under every rock. It's nowhere where anyone would ever want to go. And this guy was out there on his own, this young hiker. And he said that when he was there, just sitting in the middle of nowhere on his own, he said that this huge black triangle came down, hovered above the ground, above the desert floor, and then he said that the desert floor opened up like the deck of an aircraft carrier, because this hiker didn't know it at the time until the desert floor opened up just right next to him, and there he was. There was clearly an underground base which opened up and received this huge craft, and then this huge craft just sank slowly down into the ground, and then the desert floor closed up again. And
that's right.
In conversation with George Knapp soon afterwards, Gordon said that he made inquiries among some of the people who he knew, and Gordon certainly was well connected in that respect. I mean, there's no doubt in my own mind that Gordon was reporting the exact truth as he knew it. He said he made a few inquiries, and he said that there were 8 starships, which he called them starships. There are 8 arrow-shaped craft. They measured 600 feet by 100 feet. They're wedge-shaped arrows, and he said that this basically is the Solar Warden fleet that Henry Deacon had confirmed to us himself. And they're operating out of Utah. And
yes.
Just to
but don't forget, Bill, that he told us that same story on the TV show, but they edited it out, if you recall.
Yes, you're absolutely right. They didn't want that in there. Yes, that's right.
Yes, right.
That was a bit too close to home. But just to bring this back, it's a shame that Jim isn't with us anymore. I mean, there's no doubt whatsoever that Gordon was connected on the inside with sources of information that provided him with reliable material. And just like anybody who's in that interface position, as you have been many times and I have been quite a few times, you don't reveal your sources. You have to be very discreet with what you say, and at the same time, you're trying to get the information out in a drip feed. And as we know, there's this other side to this whole coin, that the controllers want this information out as long as it cannot be proved. They want to change the thinking of those who are aware enough to pick up what's happening bit by bit, but not too fast. Wouldn't you agree with that, Kurt?
Yes, I would. I mean, I would say that they're using us just as they're using other people. Paul Richard Price is certainly part of this group, and others that have been on this call with us earlier this morning. We are all part of a disclosure movement, if you will, and we are a bridge. I've said it before, and I think even Rich Dolan would agree that we are a bridge to the rogue space program, to the secret government, and we are the only bridge they have. And therefore, in many ways, we're absolutely vital. Now, what they let us let out and what they sort of try to commandeer and take out of our hands and disinfo after we put it out, et cetera, or even try to get to us before, how much they try to take us off the line, misdirect us, et cetera, is a fascinating sort of dance in and of itself for people who are watching. And with an astute eye, I'm sure they're kind of watching those steps as we go. But no doubt about it, they need disclosure. They need that gap to be slowly closed to some degree, because otherwise they are going to be left with a primitive human population that is so far behind them when they do decide to disclose that they simply won't be able to communicate. It will absolutely be, people will be going crazy, and literally and figuratively. I think they already are. I think people in the mainstream, I just had a conversation with a journalist who calls himself an investigative journalist in the financial sector, and he literally told me that the only thing that he saw happening, and this is somebody very astute, very relatively mainstream and gets, published, highly published and so on and so forth, and he says, is self-interest. That's all that's running the financial system, are a bunch of rather stupid guys trying to make a lot of money. That was his assessment. Just blew my mind. He didn't want to use the word conspiracy. He would never use that word because, quote unquote, he didn't want to be called crazy. And this is what we're dealing with out there. And this is somebody who is very astute in the financial sector, who is watching this game close up, and I mean very close up, and still has no clue whatsoever and doesn't even want to acknowledge that there's something else going on, that there's an agenda out there. So this is what we're dealing with.
Would say to that person who put them in touch with Catherine Austin Fitz, and then they're certainly putting right.
Yeah, well, there is a place to go. Maybe someone he would respect, at least speaks his own language rather than myself. But at any rate, I think that was a memorable phone call for him dealing with me. But at any rate, I want to say one thing about the planetoid issue, because I did talk to a whistleblower about this in depth. It's an interesting concept. In other words, we know that various ET races have very sophisticated craft. They can come and go, as you said, and they have incredible large craft. Some are probably close to the size of small moons, etc. But it is also true that they do commandeer moons and other planetoids, and then they run them through solar systems, etc. I think maybe in part because as Phobos is a satellite of Mars, and is occupied and has been occupied, as I have from very good authority, and the moon itself being one of those types of satellites, these things are occupied. They do use them when they have very large populations, for one thing, and they might be considered the slow-moving craft, and they also can make them move faster than what would be commonly considered what a planetoid or a planet would move at. So it depends what size you're talking about. But there's no doubt, maybe you would call it, like a cargo vessel type of thing, where in some cases they will actually use them. Now, I think they also use them to inhabit, for example, when their races are no longer able to inhabit whatever planet they destroyed on their way here or on their way through various solar systems. So you're talking about what may be their home in a sense, but they can actually power it and get it to move. And it is said this is in part how the moon became a satellite of the Earth, and possibly how other moons have gotten to where they are, not through any natural means.
That's absolutely not impossible. Let's just close it down that way. David Icke said that the moon is hollow. I think that is quite plausible. And once again, going back to Henry Deacon, an enormous source of information for us, he actually said that the Earth's moon was engineered into place quite a long time ago. He told us that. We just had a question on the chat. Did Borden himself have extraterrestrial contact personally? If he did, I never knew about it. Carrie, was that anything that he spoke to about on or off record?
I think he was trying to. I don't know whether he did in the end. If you remember the woman that he was sort of a sensitive who had a lot of contact herself, I believe he was kind of using her and possibly there were others to communicate with some groups. So I think he was very, very interested in doing that. He, on our interview, he insisted that he was, I think he called it, he was from Minnesota or one of those kind of those states, and said he needs this. Well, yeah, there's a saying that's something like, I have to see it before I believe it type of thing.
Show me state, and that's, oh, gosh.
That's Missouri.
Yeah, Missouri, he used to say it all the time.
Gary and Bill, may I interrupt something here right now while we're still live? I think I know who tried to call in. And it was Spirit Novell, is what I think, his daughter. And if Spirit wants to call back in, feel free to do so. We want to hear from her.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah, we would like to hear from Spirit. I mean, hey, my heart goes out to you, sir, and to Miracle right now. You guys, I know, are going through a whole lot. And your thoughts are in our prayers and thoughts right now, the passing of your father. Like I said, he was a flamboyant man, but he was tough as nails. You know, that's Gordon Novell. And once he got his feet down to something, he never let it go. Especially with the R of technology. And what I think we should really focus on.
I want to say something. I want to say that I did talk to Gordon about his family, and that he loved his family very much. He literally would lay down his life for them. I don't know whether they know that. I just want to say that he had told me this, and he did convey a huge amount of some regrets and some just a huge amount of feeling towards his children. And I just want them to know that. I know that sometimes his relationship with them was not as easy as perhaps it could be, but I do know that he conveyed to me, how very proud he was of his children, and that was very, very evident.
Oh, yeah, well, and Sarah's son later became a corporate lawyer out of Thailand, and his daughter is into acting, I do believe, now in the L.A. area, as Spirit is. Miracle, I think, is the only married one, or at least, I don't know if Spirit got married or Sir did, but I know Miracle did, and had, I think, his grandchildren. And the kids are good kids. I mean, they're good people. And, you know, if anything could happen, I hope that the legacy that Gordon leaves is for his progeny, that, you know, he at least tried, and he tried to get things to go through, even though he wasn't able to. But I want us to remember Gordon, not for the negative, but mainly for the positive, that he tried his best to open doors that are still being closed right now, and to release technology that would help save mankind. Unfortunately, right now, with his passing, it might end up causing that door to be closed, if not permanently, but for a much longer time than what was needed. And Carrie and Bill, you're the only two left in the chat right now. We have only 2 minutes left to go until the show ends. Do you have any final closing thoughts?
Gordon Novell was a fascinating man, a very brilliant man, and a trailblazer. He had the kind of personality to be that way, and he really stuck it through to the end. I know he would still be want to be here fighting right this moment. And he was also a deeply spiritual person. I know we haven't said that, but I do want to say that here. And I, for one, am very happy to have known him.
Yes, I want to echo that. For me, it was a privilege to have spent a little bit of time with him. He was a great deal of fun. He was a brilliant man. He was a visionary.